This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by our friends at TradeStation. Find out how to get free trading for 90 days at TradeStation.com.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
High flyers are getting gunned down. There's confusion over the employment report. Market rotation is taking hold, and our guest author of Extreme Money, Sanjaya Das, is our guest today on episode number 358 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome. How are you? Nice to have you with me today. It is becoming a rather volatile environment for markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit a record intraday twice this week and managed to hold it for a moment and then drop off pretty ferociously. There was a significant reversal that we saw on Friday where there was a nice move into the employment report. There was good anticipation of what was going on there. We had some interesting news out of Europe about the potential for a quantitative easing program and into the number, a pretty good setup, but yet there was major failure. In fact, the NASDAQ composite had one of its worst days in a very long time, down about 2.5%+. Small caps also took a beating. Dow Jones not down as badly, but it did start out with a lot of optimism, and the reversal, if you look at it, was pretty sharp. More importantly, we did see that the high flyers continue to get absolutely just run over, and then the car stops and they run over it again. You look at Facebook and Twitter, you look at Tesla, SolarCity, you look at the names that were really the greatest returners of profit from 2013, look at the biotechs, and they are just getting squashed. On the other hand, you're also seeing that there is a good amount of bid interest in some of the biggest names. We talked about this at length last week. We talked about this on DH Unplugged as well. But I thought that just for a moment, we would consider what is going on, why is it happening, and what does it mean? Now, you have to realize that we're coming into earnings season. Next week, it begins, and the following week, it really gets hot and heavy. We're going to be seeing that earnings are going to be coming in, and the question that is going to be asked and answered very soon is, are prices way above where they should be considering the amount of sales, earnings, and outlook? Now, last week on DH Unplugged, we talked about how there was a significant amount of guidance cuts, reduced guidance compared to estimates. Matter of fact, the largest amount of disparity between guidance and company estimates and analyst estimates for earnings for the coming quarter. The biggest variance since 2006 and 7, I believe. And that is something that we should probably pay attention to. Now, whether or not the earnings season overall is a plus, where we see the positive surprises are in the 60%, 70% like we've seen before, and sales can maintain a 50 or 60% positive surprise, well, we'll see. But already we're seeing that compared to past quarters, there's a lot of pessimism from management. And when we're seeing that, we have to say, wait a second, what does that mean? Are they sandbagging? You know how that works. Companies will come out and give managed guidance and massage the numbers to the analysts, giving them something to work with, but yet at the same time giving something for the companies to beat. If they come out overly optimistic, what will happen is that simply they may miss. If they come out pessimistic, well, stocks may come in a little bit into the earnings. You may get some shorts starting to plow in a little bit. And then when you beat earnings nicely and then maybe have a better than expected outlook, on both earnings and sales revenues, well, you get a nice pop to your stock. I wouldn't doubt that there's a lot of that going on. Now, whether or not we will see that play out, if analysts have in fact adjusted their estimates down, or if they're seeing this as just an overly pessimistic type of sandbagging that's going on by companies, is yet to be seen. We're going to find out soon enough. But yet, right now, this is an interesting change in management opinion and outlook that we've seen recently as compared to what we've seen over the last couple of years. So you need to keep that in mind and keep a watch on that. See if the company's actually coming in with much better numbers or right on. I would suspect that if, in fact, we see very, very thin beats, only one penny, and we get sales that are continuing to be lackluster at best, then there's going to be a problem with markets. And right now, here's the interesting thing. If you've noticed, over the last 6 months or so, a lot of money has been pouring into the U.S. markets as really the only place that people want to invest because they know that there's going to be a Fed that's somewhat cooperative with markets and is going to be dovish. And at the same time, the economy has been getting better and the dollar somewhat stronger. And when you add this all up and you look at the rest of the world, well, the U.S. is a pretty good place to be. Now, recently we've seen that Europe actually has been really leading the way, possibly from a rotation, a reversionary trade, where they're looking at the worst performers over a period of time and saying, hey, things are okay now, let's put our money there. Or with the fact that the euro is climbing and there's really no way to stop that at this point compared to the other countries around the world, the other currencies that are all about devaluation. And the euro is going to have a big problem with that because of the disparity and the number of countries that are involved. I'm going to ask Das about that whole issue. But the big issue and the big concern right now is, what if earnings don't play out and all this money has piled in U.S. equities? If we see that type of withdrawal and alternative move to maybe, whether it's Europe or back into some EM or maybe even to cash or bonds for that matter, well, that could be very, very destructive to a market because the over-optimistic side of things that really pounced money into equities and indices over the last 6 months at a record clip. As a matter of fact, in the latter part of 2013, we saw the strongest inflows into ETFs, U.S.-based ETFs, that we've seen in a while. Now, they did flow out a little bit in January. February came back in pretty strong. March, even. April, we're starting to see a little bit of a change in the dynamic where we're seeing the volatility pick up. Now, you wouldn't know it according to the VIX, which is still sub-15, but the volatility right now is a precursor to something that is going to happen. We're still in a consolidation point when it comes to the major indices. Yes, they clipped a little bit of a higher point, but we're not talking about a major breakout right now than the numbers that we've seen inside of 2014. We're still in that range that you can consider a consolidation for indices. Individual stocks, a little bit different. But where is the value right now? Is it going to be a play that, hey, you know what? This is a great opportunity to buy and buy the dip on any situation that we've seen recently. And if we do see an additional catalyst that causes some of these companies to move lower, like a Facebook, which has had great earnings, although the last couple of rounds we realized that their sales and their revenues may be a little bit constrained by the lack of their desire to increase their ad space and number of ads per on their pages and inside of the various conversations that they talked about. Well, we're going to have to watch that. Is it going to be the triple D's of the world, the printing, 3D printing companies that we've seen recently really take a beating? DDD and Stratasys, Exo-One, et cetera, that may in fact have a lot to offer, but their prices got well ahead of them. Now, we added a small position of triple D this week on the fact that it looked like, from all accounts, it had some downside opportunity with a little bit of a lack of volume there on the downside, about 2 points lower than we are now. But at the same time, there was a good level of support at the current prices. So we started to add a little bit of that to the portfolio on the long side. We went short some of the Chinese internet slash real estate companies, and that paid off pretty well. And we actually took back some of that position and closed it on Friday. Looking at the amount of carnage that we saw in the markets, while there could still be a significant amount of downturn, the fact of the matter is that until we start seeing a lot of the earnings, and even if we see some kind of a move lower right now on the fact that the jobs numbers were good, the Fed is going to continue with their $10 billion of drawdown of their buying program on a monthly basis, considering the jobs numbers that we saw, a 6.7 unemployment rate and 190,000 or so adds. The fact is that there's nothing out there that says things are getting a lot better on the employment front. There's nothing out there saying it's getting a lot worse. So status quo means that the Fed is going to stay where they are. Now, when we see that and we look at earnings, the big issue is going to be, an overriding issue is going to be, what are the earnings? So Alcoa is coming out on the 8th. We'll see that. I do believe that stock has run up a little bit. As a matter of fact, I think it's run up a lot more than it really should have, considering the fact of the potential production, with a couple of caveats. Number one, they stopped smeltering. They stopped the smelters in a variety of areas, cutting down production and cutting down supply. So that did bring up prices, and that's better for them. The second thing is, we're seeing that the run rate on an annual basis on automobiles is fantastic. The amount of cars that are being sold is just blowing it out. Major amounts of sales going on. Now, that being the case, that's actually a positive for the aluminum manufacturers and for some of the companies that are in the automobile supply business. Good stuff. Will it hold? We'll see. But the run rates that we're seeing, and we saw last week, pretty impressive. That has to bring us right to the discussion of Tesla, right? In the automobile, in the high flyer. Well, what's going on with Tesla? What's the drop all about? It's a company that had everything going for it, and it even saw there was a nice couple of reversals of some of the opinion on states that are going to allow them to sell, et cetera, and they got the China deal going on. What is going on with Tesla? One of the things, if you read some of the articles that recently came out over the last several months, has been about where Tesla has gotten their income from. Where are the revenues coming from? Now, some of them are from tax credits. As a matter of fact, we talked about this, John C. Dvorak and myself, we talked about how the amount of money per car that is made by Tesla in regards to the car itself and profits, and then you add on top of it the amount of tax credits for environmental and carbon credits that they sell each and every car, is amazing. The amount of profits is like $40,000 or so on these credits. Now, California just recently started to reverse this, slow down the offering of credits, and thereby what you're going to probably find is that the profit margins for Tesla on each and every car are going to drop. And I believe that ahead of that, you're seeing the stock really sell off, with the reality that they can't maintain this type of earnings power, because they're not producing that many cars, with the fact that if there is a reduction in credits and the amount of excess money they make each and every car, that there's going to be a change in the dynamic in terms of earnings. Now, still, the company, very, very popular. Cars, they're increasing sales there. But if, in fact, we do see this drop in the amount of credit per car that is credited to them, and the potential revenues and the bookkeeping. Remember, two quarters ago, I was concerned. I said, look at these, there's a bunch of these one-time numbers that are really goosing up the sales. I don't know how long they're going to be able to hold that. Now, meanwhile, they came out with a blockbuster number the following quarter or the quarter after. And now you may see the reversal as reality sets in on Tesla. So just be careful with that name. In terms of the social media stocks, though, you gotta really scratch your head and wonder what was going on before and what is going on now. Why was everybody getting in? Why is everybody getting out? Now, one reason that you'll see and one discussion that you'll hear is the conversation all about rotation. There's a gigantic rotation going on that the algorithms, the hedge funds, the institutions are involved in. And this rotation is taking money out of many of the major winners over the last year or so and rotating it into others, particularly rotating it into the Dow Jones 30 type of stocks. Those stocks with a high dividend paying ability, with a dividend, and with very clean balance sheets with excess cash available. Now, why is that? Well, a few things. One, the big issue, interest rates. Are interest rates going to go higher? And if they are, well, what's going to happen to some of the companies that rely on debt? Small caps, as a matter of fact, is one of the ones that really don't do as well when interest rates are moving higher. But on the other hand, Andrew, wait a minute. You have to realize interest rates are going higher. That is a identification of an economy that's doing better, because as interest rates rise, really what you're seeing is that economies are probably doing better and the government is allowing for the rates to rise, removing stimulus because it's doing its own thing and kind of cruising. So on one hand, you have this big debate of whether or not an improving economy is actually good for some stocks, particularly small caps and the social media and the momos. And on the other hand, you have to look at, well, what about the fact that stimulus will be withdrawn and interest rates go up? So that's the kind of yin and yang which is playing right now in the market, the rotation into large cap names from small caps out of the big winners into some of the players that may do well with an economy that is doing better with a growing GDP, et cetera. Now, we'll see if, in fact, that holds. I got to tell you, from everything that I can see, it looks like that when stimulus is withdrawn, things are going to get pretty ugly. We've seen it time and time again over the past 5 years. Is this time different? I don't think so. I think the excess liquidity in these markets right now is all about the stimulus, the amount of money that's being pumped into the markets, into the economy. And when that's removed, one of the things you'll note is that buying pressure just runs away. And one of the other things you'll notice is, and really the big picture here, is that there's not a lot of selling that's going on. Sure, on a few days here and there's a lot of selling, but usually what you're finding is that for the most part, it's buying pressure that holds and the selling is not happening. That's why you're getting valuations and PE ratios that are expanding, because they're not willing to give up their stock. There's less stock on the market due to buybacks and the fact that a lot of people are just buying and holding. And what's happening is, until that turns, until the capitulation of, okay, I'm holding forever, I'm not going to sell ever, when that turns is when you see that selling pressure really kick up very substantially. So we're going to watch all of this, keep an eye on that. We've actually had some really good producers of nice and quick returns at Trigger Point Research. If you haven't checked that out, it's a free trial for 14 days over at triggerpointresearch.com. You get the breaking up, the breaking down. You get the bouncing candidates. We've had a couple of shorts recently that really have done very, very well. So it's a 14-day free trial. Check that out. Now, before we get to a guest, I want to mention TradeStation for a second, because this is something that another one of those great things that you have to have with all the high-frequency trading that goes on and all the things that are out there in the markets that can really take a trading or a short-term swing trading strategy right to the brink of extinction. One of the things you have to have is something great like a fantastic charting platform. You have to have something that you can scan and find stocks that are breaking up, that are moving. They have a couple of different things. Their scanner, they have their hot lists. The hot lists are those stocks, and you could change the stock listing, that maybe in the Dow Jones, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the small cap, that are really moving on a two-minute basis, that are breaking out on the high and the low, and that are something you need to pay attention to. They have superior charting to anything that I've seen out there. So if you're doing any kind of technical analysis, this is the place you want to be. And best of all, there's a 30-day or actually 90-day free commission, and you can get all sorts of benefits in terms of waiver of the cost of the platform. So why not check it out? There's going to be a link on thedisciplinedinvestor.com right to the left side, and on this particular show notes, you'll find exactly how to sign up, and I encourage you to do so. If you're using another platform, take me up on this offer. Check out TradeStation. You're really going to enjoy it. Let's get to our guest. And we're here with our good friend Das, all the way from down under in Australia. Das, how are you, my friend?
I'm well, Andrew. And you?
I'm pretty good. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the globally amusing economic situations. We have a variety of juxtapositions when it comes to who's tightening, who's loosening. We look at, you know, the ongoing rhetoric. And I think this week, the biggest one we saw was from Mario Draghi, who once again is trying to talk the markets into believing that his verbal communications are all that are necessary in order to drop the euro and to provide all sorts of support?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. Mark Twain once, I think, remarked that when he was listening to supposedly very clever people, that he wasn't sure whether there were really very clever people putting him on or some people who were really stupid who meant it. And I think that's probably what markets think about most of the authorities, including central bankers at the moment. But I think you have to be a little bit cautious because these guys have quite considerable firepower. But the problem is they haven't really got any weaponry left. You know, interest rates are at pretty much zero. Fiscal policy is constrained. So this business about forward guidance, which always reminds me of Robin Williams' joke about a UK or an English bobby, an English policeman who doesn't carry weapons, as you know, saying to the thief, "Stop, or I'll shout louder."
Right.
So I think Draghi is just doing this. Because, look, let's be honest. He and everybody agrees, I suspect, in their heart of hearts, they're going to have to launch a quantitative easing program in the European context. Simply because, number one, growth is very, very slow. Number two, deflation risks are rising. Number three, they've got budget deficits to finance. I think what most people didn't pick up this week, that the Italians and the French basic budget deficits are well above what they agreed to do with the European Union. Not that that's a surprise. France hasn't had a budget surplus, I think, since the mid-70s. So to have one
the,
now...
The, you mean the 1870s?
Well, that might be true, too. I think it was the 1970s, actually. But basically, I think what Draghi is trying to do what he did with the outright monetary transaction. So by just threatening to do something to have some sort of effect. And I think the other really disturbing thing about all of this is what we've talked about before, which is the currency wars. Obviously, the Europeans are trying to weaken the euro. The U.S. is quite alarmed because Yellen's tightening, or not really tightening, but basically her announcement to taper and potentially increase interest rates made the dollar a bit stronger. And obviously, in my view, the Chinese are very, very clearly on a path of devaluing the yuan. And the Japanese have, for the last year, tried to weaken the yuan. So we have all these dysfunctional things going on. And in the middle of course, all of this is the fact that the stock markets take every piece of news, basically digest it, and put it out the other end of the system and decide, what the heck, let's just go and buy. So it's just a very dysfunctional environment at the moment.
You know, it's funny because we talk about how Draghi is going to do the quantitative easing, or at least something has to come up. And one of the things that they talked about was, first of all, they used the word framework, which already turned me off. And they talked about how they're probably only going to be buying bank loans. And I said to myself, wait a minute, that's not quantitative easing. If you think about it, banks are private institutions, right? Mm-hmm. And quantitative easing is the process of devaluing your currency some way. But by technically, buying internal assets and maybe not doing a wash of them and not, Anyway, it'll come to me. But the point is now they're going to look at buying bank loans. And I was scratching my head saying, what in the world does that have to do with quantitative easing? Unless what they're doing is bastardizing the idea, trying to couch it and to frame it in a way that they're saying it's quantitative easing, but really just going out and recapitalizing the banks.
Well, I think this is actually the interesting things about Mario Draghi's approach. Firstly, he's got a fundamental problem. You know, if you actually look at the Eurozone, doing quantitative easing isn't that easy. And the reason is you've got 17 members. So the fundamental thing is if you're going to buy government bonds, whose bonds are you going to buy? And the fundamental problem here is they came up with this idea, well, we'll buy pro rata to their shares, which means you basically buy a lot of German bunds, you buy a lot of French OATs. The problem with that is those are not the guys you need to buy because their yields are almost at ridiculously low levels anyway. But if you do anything else, then it becomes a question of, well, you're buying more of his than you're buying more of mine. Mm-hmm. So that's the first problem. The second problem is you'll remember that some months earlier, the German Constitutional Court ruled that OMT had a number of problems. So basically, Mario Draghi is extremely cautious about anything which would suggest financing governments. So he can't go down that path. So he's gone down this rather bizarre path of buying bank loans. Then the problem becomes, okay, if you're going to buy bank loans, In the U.S., it's not easy, but it can be done because of the securitization market, where all these loans are bundled up into securities anyway. The problem in Europe is that market is not nearly as large or as substantial, and so that's going to become very difficult for them to actually have actually an instrument to do this. And then, of course, there is the sideshow that's going on, which is the banking union and the AQR, the Asset Quality Review. We all know the European banks have about $1 trillion in bad debts. And, for instance, the Italian banks have somewhere around 200 billion of euros of bad debts. Now, those banks need, as you correctly say, to be recapitalized. Now, the problem is, who's going to give the capital, number one? And we all know it's going to come from the local governments, basically. The problem, of course, is they don't have the money. So you're absolutely correct. Mario Draghi may be thinking this is a neat way of essentially achieving two things. But that in itself won't do what I think you're correctly identifying, which is weaken the currency. All that'll do is put the bank balance sheets in a little better place. But that doesn't necessarily mean credit will start to circulate any better. And there's also an issue in Europe, which is quite important, is lending to small and medium-sized enterprises, where most of the jobs are created, we know, is absolutely stuck at very, very low levels, and the rates are very high. So the problem here is he's got like 5 or 6 policy objectives, and he's trying to find a sledgehammer to do all of them. And unfortunately, I don't think he's picked up the right sledgehammer.
Yeah, and he's got also that, you know, I got to tell you something about Draghi. Draghi's got that kind of swagger. You know, he's got that kind of smirk at all times, and you know,
he's Italian. What do you expect?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point there. You got to wait for waiting for him to burst out in some kind of Italian song. You know, he seems to always have it together, and you know, he tells you and just you know a little bit of hey, we're going to do this, in mafioso style, and you know. But the thing is that I guess what's really interesting is that is there going to be a shift? Because right now we saw that this year the European stock markets have been pretty much the best performers.
They have.
You know, we've seen that U.S. is secondary in terms of not really moving anywhere, not taking any big ups or downs, except for last week at the end of the week. And we saw that EM has been really hammered. Although what's really interesting about EM is that they had a tremendous downstroke due to the fact that there was going to be this pullback on the bond buying programs in the U.S., and that was a consistent theme. Dollar would be moving higher. And then miraculously, they just turned around like nothing happened. And this is kind of the short-term memory that's going on with markets that have the expectation that governments will do what they can to bail things out. I mean, we saw that you know, Brazil popped up. India was on fire for a while there. And then you know, we saw the things like what was really good last year, Japan, and was down 15% at one point this year.
I think there's a couple of things about that I would note. One is, I think it's the case of looking for the best of the worst. And Europe certainly seems to have bottomed. Growth has started at very modest levels. And so essentially people are looking to bottom fish. And you know what people are like. They're looking at all the metrics like PE ratios, value to book, and all that sort of stuff. And saying, well, it looks a bit undervalued. But to be very blunt with you about all these markets, essentially there's a lot of stuff going on, which is based on the fact that I really don't think this is long-term value, but I'll buy it. It's going to go up, and then I can flick it. I had a really interesting discussion with a couple of fund managers who buy high-yield or junk bonds in the States. And he was saying to me that the predominant trend over the last 12 months has been to buy CCC or B-minus bonds. And I said, but, you know, if the economy weakens or anything goes wrong, they're going to get hammered. And he said, yes, but everybody's assuming that they can actually exit before that. They're saying they get a good ride for a year, then they're going to flick them because they're all going to know when the big one is coming. And this game is being played. And just picking up on that emerging market theme, the risks in emerging markets look very, very benign, but they're not. All the stock markets have done very well, but in local currency terms, if you translate them into U.S. dollars, say on a 12-month time horizon, they don't look as good. The second thing is they've all got elections. A lot of them have elections. Indonesia, India, South Africa, Brazil, they're all coming up to an election cycle that creates instability. And the last and interesting issue is the reason, say, the currencies have actually stabilized is because some of those countries have put up interest rates very dramatically, and that'll flow through into the economy at some point in time. So there's all these sorts of risks, and within that, EM investors have gone kind of for the you know, what I call the Starship Enterprise thing, to go where no man has ever gone before. And so they've basically moved from traditional emerging markets like the BRICS, Indonesia, and so forth. They're going for frontier markets, which is places that I always joke where you have to take an ox and cart from the airport to your hut.
Right, exactly.
And so they've gone into that because they just think there's value there. But it's all the dash for trash because of yield.
Yeah, it's amazing. We're talking with Sanjay Das, and he is the author of Extreme Money. And Das has been, he has counseled many of the governments and bond experts, et cetera, on the idea of, hey, you know, is there value here and what's going on? We got to talk to him about a lot of things. I want to also talk about China here. You know, China, I found it very interesting. I was always just amused and astonished at the idea that the U.S. would come in and, not only the U.S., but the world really, would come in and would put such a incredible amount of pressure on China to increase the value of their currency because they believe that their currency was being manipulated. Now, let's not get into the fact that we realize that every other currency is manipulated in the same aspect. But what was interesting was that China went along with it for a while. They had a very tight band that was increasing for a long time, even when things weren't going so well. And they were going along with this until it got to a point that they just couldn't do it any longer. Their economy started slowing. We see that the PMI and the manufacturing reports have shown that there's a defined slowdown. Their shadow banking is a problem. How bad is the economy and the loan situation in China right now?
Look, I think none of us know the real answer, because unless you're inside China and you have really on-the-ground knowledge, it's pretty hard. Because looking at Chinese statistics is not exactly a guide to detailed knowledge of anything.
Right, it's not a science.
It's not a science in that way.
Right.
The second thing is China is a very, very complicated place. And I always remember that every time I hear a Western analyst talking about China, I'm always reminded of what the former French President Charles de Gaulle said. China is a big country inhabited by many Chinese. And I think basically Western understanding of China has not greatly progressed beyond that at any stage.
Right.
But look, let's take a couple of very simple things. The first is, their debt has increased very dramatically. It's now anywhere between 200 to 250% of GDP. Now, but say compare that to the United States, it doesn't look so bad. But then you look at per capita income. People forget that in the U.S., despite all its troubles, per capita income, on average, I'm saying, is around about 40,000 U.S. per person. Okay? In China, it's six. So you've got a poorer country with higher debt, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. That's number one. Number two, if you look at two or three measures, like one measure we look at is how quickly has debt to GDP increased. Now, generally, there's a 30 to 5 rule, which means that if your debt to GDP has increased by, say, more than 30% over a five-year time horizon, history shows it tends to create some problems. And China's certainly done that. The second thing is you look at what's called DSR, debt service ratios. And the debt service ratio, once it gets above about 20% of GDP to pay interest and principal, you tend to have problems. And China, it's over 30%. So the point I'm making is that essentially if you look at very bald statistics, there's a problem. But the real underlying issue is, looking at the statistics only gives you one part of the story. The real issue is China needs to grow very rapidly to keep essentially social cohesion and political control. And the way they've done it since 2007-2008 is essentially using the state-owned banks, or what we call the policy banks, to essentially lend money to another part of the state, which is state-owned enterprises, to make these massive investments. And look, those stories about, you know, ghost cities and so forth, it's like everything. Some of them are apocryphal, but there is a bit of truth in it. There's massive overcapacity in China. We all know that. And the issue is, okay, well, that's good. In the previous cycles, what's happened is China has overbuilt, but because of the strong growth in the external economy and strong growth in China, it's like a child. You grow into your clothes. The problem this time around is I think the overcapacity is far too great. The debt levels are far too great. The external environment is far too slow to bail you out. And so what this is going to happen is all these loans aren't going to come back. Now, if you talk privately to Chinese bankers, they will say that they don't really know, but somewhere between 10 to 25% of these loans is not going to come back. And that's a massive amount we're talking about.
That's tremendous.
That's a tremendous amount.
Yeah.
And the issue then is, well, okay, how does that end? Now, there is what I would call the sort of doom and gloom scenario, which is essentially the whole thing falls apart in a classic Western-style banking bust. The other one is what I would call the people with Chinese stars in their eyes and rose-colored glasses who say the Chinese are the best-managed economy in the world. They are all-knowing seers, which I call the Confucius syndrome. And they basically will say, no, 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 they're under control. They'll manage this. They've done this before. I fall into what I call the middle of that because I think the Middle Kingdom will have a muddle through. And the muddle through will be what I have seen before. This is, by the way, my third banking crisis in China. It's not new. It's happened before. And so what happens every time is they do a couple of things. The first thing they do is they move bad debt from the banking system into these asset management companies, basically bad banks. And they have these vehicles from the last crisis, and they have been reshuffling assets, doing lots of things to prepare these vehicles to take on more of these bad debts from the banks when they come through. The second thing they're going to do is they're going to arrange for recapitalization of the banks to some degree. And finally, what they're going to do, and this is the most damaging part to the economy, all this talk about reform in China and reform of the financial system, I think is unlikely to progress at the rate that Western analysts are assuming. They will keep the deposit rates very, very low under inflation, and they will keep a very big spread between the lending rates and the borrowing rates, the deposit rates. And what they will do is use the big stream of earnings to gradually write off the bad debts over time. It's a time-honored way that they'll do it. And you can see the problem in that. There's two problems in that. The first is, obviously, this famed rebalancing between investment and consumption can't happen, because you need people to save a lot to keep the banking system going, and you won't pay them sufficiently for their saving. So the consumption is slower in terms of growing. The second and the biggest problem, in my view, is it doesn't deal with these bad debts, because we know these assets are never going to pay back anything. So under those circumstances, writing them off and starting all over again is far better for the economy in the longer run. They won't do that. So you'll have a zombie economy where gradually more and more of the capital is tied up in stuff, which is non-producing. And the last, and I think the ultimately most damaging, is once you get on this sort of heroin trip of debt-fueled, investment-driven growth, it's hard to get off. And we saw signs of it this week, because the economy is clearly slowing far more than the statistics are showing, because the government announced new fiscal measures and new investments in, guess what?
Railway lines.
New buildings. Yeah. And I'm sitting there going, I think we've seen this movie before. And so the problem is they can't get off it. So they can't actually deal with the problems, because while they're trying to deal with the problems on one hand, they're creating the next problem on the other. So I think what will happen in China is not the collapse, but a gradual slowing. And the problem with the gradual slowing is, you know, you're assuming people have a greater degree of control over all this than they actually do. And in China, everybody assumes, because it's a command economy run very centrally, it's under control. It actually, in my experience, is not. There's a very famous episode between Richard Nixon, when he went to open up China in terms of international affairs in 1972. Richard Nixon was meeting with Mao Zedong, the then great leader of China, and Richard Nixon said to Mao Zedong, look, you know, congratulations on bringing this vast country together. And Mao looked at him and sneered, I have control over Beijing almost.
Right.
So the problem is going to be they're not going to be able to get everything done in the way they do. Well, and that's going to create its own risk.
Listen, Das, the most amazing thing is that if you consider the size and the vastness of China and all the prefectures and all the different towns and villages and cities and all that, and you look at the amount of potential variation that you could have in economic statistics, right? And,
yep.
And you have a PMI estimate of 50.7, and the actual number comes out at 50.7, whereas everywhere else in the world is never right on. I mean, you know, not never, but very rarely. It's somewhere in between a point, a little bit here.
Yeah.
China seems to be miraculous at hitting that number all the time. And what's amazing is I find it impossible for them to actually have the ability to do so, to have that kind of a clean situation.
look, the local statistics, and I know this from personal experience, if you go to any of the regions, they are given essentially a target at the start of the year. And essentially, if they don't meet that, their political futures are obviously less savory. So they will meet the targets, and they'll just make up the numbers.
Right.
They'll just
exactly.
make up the numbers.
Exactly.
And the fascinating thing about them is there's an old Chinese saying which translates into roughly, the mountains are high, the emperor is far away. So how the hell is the emperor going to know
right.
what's really going
exactly.
on?
Exactly. But the funny
so
thing is
meaningless.
But the funny thing is, we all believe it. I mean, investors believe this stuff, and that is, you only can hope that the emperor's new clothes can hold out forever, because if ever the curtain is raised and we see behind what's really going on there, there could be a significant amount of investor sentiment change in all this, because really, it's amazing how important we put on the Chinese statistics when in fact we've seen just recently the admission by China that their export numbers are BS.
Absolutely. And the export numbers, we all know that the Chinese businesses are moving money offshore. And the reason we know that is we know they systematically over-invoice and manipulate the invoices. And I've said for years, the export statistics and import statistics are kind of have to be adjusted for that. How you adjust, I've got no idea.
Right.
But I know this goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to actually adjust that. And I think we're now seeing acknowledgement. There's two things that really fascinate me about investors' attitude to China. One is all the Chinese are trying to get their money out. All the foreigners are trying to get their money in.
Yeah.
And that's just a strange discord to me.
Same thing in Japan.
Yeah, same thing in Japan. And the other thing which absolutely disturbs me is if I look at foreign businesses, real businesses, okay, these are the Procter & Gambles and so forth who are operating in China, they have their challenges. They have their challenges, they have their struggles, and they don't look that great. But portfolio investors seem to completely ignore that and say China's a great place. And I'm sort of sitting here going, well, somebody has not quite got this right, but the problem is I don't know who it is.
Right. Yeah, and at the end of the day, if you start fighting the trend, look what happened with Yum. I mean, the sales were down dramatically after the Chinese flu, and all the people in China were saying, hey, what, you know what, we're not eating chicken for a while. But yet the stock didn't dip for a very, very long time. Let's switch over, though. I want to talk to you about foot and mouth disease. It seems that our newly appointed and recently activated Fed chief, Janet Yellen, had her first press conference a few weeks back, and was... put into a corner by her own doing by a question from a reporter. And that reporter basically just was asking, well, when are rates going to rise? And she fumfed around, and you probably saw the replay of this or the actual TV when it was on. And she blurted out, 6 months after the end of the bond buying program, which shook investors a bit because not in the history, it seems, of a Fed, have they ever had any kind of qualifying date that would be the end of anything?
Yeah, it was very, very odd that she tried to be specific. And, I think there is a universal acknowledgement that she is perhaps not in her element
yeah.
in the press conference. I think that was probably a little bit unfair. But if that was the case, I think she should have just basically said, we're not going to have a press conference. I'm just going to read a prepared statement and goodbye, good luck. And it would have been much smarter. But I think what was disturbing is the inconsistencies in the message. And I particularly liked the bit when she started to talk about the Fed funds forecast, which you referred to as these little dots. And I think she said something like, I've got to warn you that these dots move up and down, and I really don't think it's appropriate to read very much into it. Which actually I think is quite a reasonable position to take, because they're prepared before the meeting. So they're basically prepared by the staff. And I don't know why they release it, frankly. And then to suddenly say 6 months, which would really be May next year, is kind of disturbing. So it's not the fact of what she said. It's the fact that there's these misleading messages. And then, of course, she felt that she needed to clarify.
Yeah, a week later.
Yeah. And I think the one thing I've learned in life is that you essentially, once you're in a hole, the only way you can get out is to stop digging. And all this stuff about what she's looking at and so forth just creates a huge problem. And I have some sympathy for her, because the press read every statement and analyze and parse it endlessly, so it's kind of difficult. But I think she should just go back and read some of Greenspan's stuff. I remember him saying, I know you believe you understood what I think I said, but I'm not sure you realize what you heard is not what I meant.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah, we got to get...
I think you should learn some of those lines.
Yeah, we got to learn some of the Greenspan ease, which was, I remember that, and I always found it, to be honest with you, I loved it because it was so confounding and confusing. I could watch him for a half hour talk, and at the end I'd be, I have no idea what he actually just said.
I think there's a statement that they all use called constructive ambiguity. And I've always said that the real problem with modern central bankers is they really confuse people. They don't think they're central bankers. They think they're intellectuals and celebrities. And the problem with that is that you're going to be subject to a lot of public scrutiny. And I think central banking is essentially, as you earlier said, magic. And in magic, you need to maintain a certain degree of distance.
Yeah,
and I think they spend too much time in front of the cameras, in my view. It's just a disaster.
You know what the most amazing thing was, though? After Greenspan left the Fed, right? And
yep.
Now he's in all of a sudden, I understood everything he said. I thought that was amazing. How all of a sudden his language changed, his directness changed, his ambiguity changed, and the ability for me to, and I said, maybe it's me. Maybe all of a sudden I've gotten into the rhythm. And then I realized he's talking in normal English.
Right. Exactly.
And that's kind of funny because, you know, the idea, and I think the thing that will never, it's never going to happen, but the reality is that the Fed's job is to essentially spur on the economy and, you know, create a level of sentiment that is such that no matter what happens, somehow they'll be there to catch it. More so in the last 5 years than I think in the last, you know, few decades. And investors have taken every word of that to mean that, hey, you know what, if you're going to be there, fine. I don't really care what the economics are, because really there has been an incredible detachment between the economic realities and the Fed. And one of the most disturbing things that I have found recently is I started to think back of other times that we've been in a similar economic circumstance as we are today in the U.S. And I said, okay, you know, we have an unemployment rate that's unreasonably high considering where we were. We have manufacturing where it is. We have earnings where they are. And I started to think about it. I don't recall another time that we had this much stimulus going into the economy with an economy at the level that it is now.
Well, I'll give you a number which is quite staggering. The U.S. is about a $16 trillion economy. It's growing at, say, roughly give or take 2%, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's about, say, $320 billion of additional activity every year. And to create that, the government has to run a budget deficit of about $500 billion. And then on top of that, you've got stimulus from the Fed, which, let's just take their quantitative easing. Even at the low level that we're talking about, that's about another $600 billion. Plus, they're reinvesting all the coupons and the principal repayments of the stuff. So say about $800 billion in total. So you're talking about $1.3 trillion going in to create about 320 of additional activity. That doesn't make much sense to me, does it?
No, it doesn't. Not only that, if you look at the amount of money that was actually spent by the Fed, about $4.5 trillion, and you say that maybe it saved, created, or did something for about 4 million jobs, it's about $1 million a job.
Indeed.
And that is crazy.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think it's absolutely right. And I think, look, I don't want to bag central bankers, because part of their problem is the politicians and the legislature has absolved themselves of all responsibility.
Yep.
And just passed the economy over to them, says, you know, this is the hospital pass, you take it. And so they're in a very difficult position. But to some extent, I think they are making a terrible rod for their own back, because they'll be held responsible for all of this, which, in my view, monetary policy cannot solve the real problems of the economy. It just simply can't.
Right.
And that's the real issue.
Nor can a communications policy, let's be honest.
No, that's absolutely right. And I'm always taken by the wonderful comments by, and you were talking about Mario Draghi. And, you know, the two things I remember about Mario Draghi is his famous statement in 2012 of, I will do whatever it takes. And then last year in October, he said, we have a vast array of instruments. And, you know, I'm quite always amused by the press who turn up at this stuff. If somebody said to me, we have a vast array of instruments, my immediate hand would go up and say, Mr. President, what are they exactly,
right,
and how will they work?
Right. And you wouldn't be, and you would not be invited back?
No, I don't think I'd be invited back.
You wouldn't be invited back?
Look, I don't get invited back to most things, so
yeah,
I'm used to that.
Yeah, well, if I had you over the house, I would. Now, let me ask you one other thing, and we'll close on this. High-frequency trading has been getting the incredible amount of exposure this week. Michael Lewis came out with his book, and now all of a sudden it's like a light bulb went off, which is amazing to me, that the press is all over this, which irritates the hell out of me. Because we know this has been going on in a couple different methods. We know the algo trading. We know the flash trading, which is prior to other trades going in. Well, you know, all the different types of high frequency, that genre that's out there. We know this is going on for a long time. Politicians and regulators have done nothing about this. All of a sudden, you see that there is all this play. There's a lot of fighting going on between the exchanges. We have certain institutions that are coming out with non-HFT trading platforms that can't be supposedly, you know, clipped by the HFT traders. We see that regulators and the FBI, the Department of Justice, all these places are looking into it, and it's mind-boggling. What's going on?
Look, I think I call this the Michael Lewis effect. So, you know, Michael Lewis is basically, he must be thanking his lucky stars. His books are going to do really well.
Right.
But fundamentally, I think you need to take a deep step back and a deep breath. The first thing is, what is HFT? Look, we've had market makers in every asset class I can think of, including equities, since I have been in markets, and I'm sure before then. All initially the electronic trading was basically mechanizing that process.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, that obviously is necessary. And then the next problem becomes, okay, does that confer artificial advantages to people? And sure, and I think over time, the dark pools, then the high-frequency trading in the form of algorithmic trading, the getting information in advance, getting unfair advantages, has been going on for 20 years. It's nothing new. The interesting thing about that is the two cases are very clear. One is that's very good because it essentially gives liquidity and types a bit off of spreads. And the bad is, okay, that gives certain people unfair advantages and also effectively creates an unfair market because people don't actually have access to that. And that's the case. Now, I don't think you're ever going to balance that perfectly. I think it's a physical impossibility to balance that perfectly. Now, the question then is, okay, how do you balance that properly? And how do you make sure that everybody is not actually unhappy with that sort of equation of where they are? Because if ordinary investors think that they're being treated fairly in any market, I think they need to take a cold shower. They've never been treated fairly in any market.
Right.
So that's the fundamental thing. Now, the interesting thing is that all these investigations and so forth that are going on, I actually think they're going to come up to great difficulty in finding a prosecutable case. Firstly, who are you going to prosecute? The computer?
Well, I
mean, the computer is doing great.
Right, okay. But the creators of these systems...
Well, the creator of the system, if I was the creator of the system, my legal case would be, look, I was asked to write an algorithm which did this, I did that.
Mm. Okay, well, how about the company that's running it?
That's probably the more likely one to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I think fundamentally they're going to go after all the banks.
and rightfully so, because what they could do is they could extract money, make it look good for the public, and then pump more money back in on the back end through the Fed.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's all going to go around to the complete. And I've said we've had a regulator and a legal-led recovery. So basically, get a law degree is my advice. It's just not productive. But the other thing which is fascinating about all of this is that the Michael Lewis book is not saying anything that hasn't been said before. Because as you know, there was a book by Scott Patterson some time ago. He pointed out some of these risks as well. I just find it extraordinary. We not only now live in a celebrity culture, but we now need to have a celebrity point out that there is a problem for it to be a problem. It's quite a remarkable culture.
Scott Patterson, I had him on the show. Scott Patterson didn't get as much play as Lewis is getting. Because Lewis is a storyteller.
I just thought he should have changed his name to Michael Lewis.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, by the way, I'd like to go back to your book, your Extreme Money, and I'm still wondering when the movies are going to come out. I just saw The Wolf on Wall Street last week for the first time, and I know that you're going to have me in there for a cameo or
play some kind. Well, I've talked to Martin Scorsese, but he took one look at me and he said, "You're not attractive enough,
really,
and you haven't basically licked enough cocaine off women's breasts or been around women. And I said, I'm ugly and I'm not particularly interested in all of those. He said, that's why there's going to be no movie made. Oh. So I'm going to Bollywood, where I'm regarded as a much more marketable.
Very
thing.
Nice. I'll meet you but there. I'll be there in October.
Yeah, but the problem is, they said, can you sing and dance? And I said, no. He said, oh, that's a big problem because all those are just song numbers. You know, it's basically a Bollywood movie is a series of MTV film clips stuck together.
I've watched plenty of Bollywood clips. They can't sing or dance either.
Well, I'll have to go back and have a look at some, and I'll plead my case. You can plead my case for me. Andrew, I appoint you my agent as far as Bollywood is concerned.
All right. Well, I'll be there. I will. I'll be there in October in India, actually. And I'm looking forward to that trip, so it should be very interesting. Das, always a pleasure. Check out Das's books, of course, Extreme Money. Das, what's your Twitter? You have a Twitter access address?
I don't tweet, chirp. Nothing. I don't do anything, really.
No?
I'm lazy.
We got to come up with like a burp account, maybe. Something.
Yeah, actually, I could call myself the Burkard financier.
Oh, you're nuts. All right, we'll talk soon. Hey, thank you very much for shedding some good light on some subjects that needed it.
Good to talk to you, Andrew.
Okay, buddy boy. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And as always, a great guest. That's why Das, you just heard it. That's why Das is always one of the top requested guests on this show. Great stuff from him. If you have any questions, of course, you can email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I also encourage you that on Tuesday at 11 a.m., I'm going to be holding a webinar over at TradeStation. Every other Tuesday we do that, and we usually have a webinar on trigger charts on Wednesdays that follows that up. But, you know, it's great because we talk about things in stocks and ETFs, and we talk about, for example, this week coming up, we're going to talk about the rotation, how to identify those stocks that are going to be moving, and looking at a variety of different ways to find the rotation and the winners, and maybe even find out who are going to be the losers when that rotation goes on, looking at the sectors themselves and the underlying securities. So make sure that if you have any desire to learn a little bit about that, you could go over to the blog post here, or you can go over to TradeStation, whatever you want. And you can sign up for the webinars or just look up stocks and ETF webinar, Andrew Horowitz or something like that. And it'll take you right there, 11 a.m. in the morning, Eastern time on TradeStation. And finally, I want to mention to you that if you haven't checked it out yet, of course, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, as well as the global allocations are available to you. You're not sure where the markets are going? Let us help you. We manage money. If you like what we talk about on the show, if you like the concepts that we have, if you like some of the substance and the ideas, well, why not have your portfolio managed by us? All you have to do is go over to the website. There's a lot of little links that you can click. Find out more about Arrow, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, and the Global Allocation Strategy. That's it for this show. Thanks for joining me. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.